You're listening to Salmon Farming Inside and Out, a podcast series brought to you by Aquaculture North America. This podcast is sponsored by Imperial 75, a cargo-branded feed product. As a high-purity, high-protein corn concentrate, Imperial 75 gives you more freedom to formulate, more freedom to innovate, and the power to achieve more. Find out more at imperial75.com.
Hi, and welcome back to the Salmon Farming Inside and Out podcast. My name's Ian Roberts, your host for the next half hour. Thanks for coming back. And if you haven't heard previous episodes, please visit Aquaculture North America and check out last season. And this is the second episode of season two. I'm excited about this episode. I think we can do some myth busting in this episode, because we've got someone that has the credentials and actually knows what she's talking about. And, you know, I've been a salmon farmer for 31 years, and I've read a lot of headlines, and some of them that stick out for me, kind of the attacks on the nutritional value of salmon, or perhaps some exaggerations about contaminants in salmon. And I go back to 2004 when the headlines were about PCBs in farm salmon. At that time, there was a claim that farm-raised salmon had high levels of PCB compared to wild salmon. The truth was, I think, of the threshold levels around the world, both wild and farm salmon were 1% or 2% of allowable limits. So the headlines were nonsense. And that's when I really kind of woke up to the fact that science can be manipulated, headlines can be manipulated, and it's really hard to dig down to the truth. It means you actually have to read a scientific study, and that can be really long and boring. Other ones I can think of, omega-3s. Over the last decade, there's been some headlines that omega-3s are low in farm-raised salmon because the diet is changing. And I think my favorite as of late, and I don't know who started this, but there's a headline out there on Yahoo and social media that says farm-raised salmon is the world's most toxic food. Wow. Unbelievable. And I just, before this podcast recording, I just kind of Googled one headline, and that headline says farm salmon is just as toxic to human health as junk food. These are all the headlines that that have kind of attacked the product. And that's why I am so thrilled today that we're joined by Dr. Stephanie Colombo. Dr. Colombo is the Associate Professor and Canadian Research Chair at the Aquaculture Nutrition Division at Dalhousie University in Nova Scotia, Canada. Dr. Colombo, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
You're very welcome. Stephanie or Dr. Colombo?
Stephanie, please.
And that's what I'll use. Absolutely. So thanks so much. You heard my intro there, and I think I saw you react to a couple of those headlines. Maybe you haven't seen them, but they are out there, and I often get questions about it from customers or others. So pleased to have you on the program. For those that haven't read your materials, read your studies, or seen some of your studies profiled in newspapers, can you just tell me a bit about yourself and your career path into where you are now?
Sure. So I'm a professor at a university right now. What brought me here? I was always interested in marine life. I loved visiting the ocean as a kid, was snorkeling at 6 and scuba diving at 12. So that is just kind of part of who I am. I'm just really passionate about it. So I did a Bachelor of Science in marine and freshwater biology, naturally. But I didn't know anything about aquaculture until I learned a little bit about it in my last year. After I graduated, I was looking for jobs. I'm from Ontario, not a lot of jobs in marine biology. So I was looking at, you know, jobs East and West Coast, and there were a lot of jobs in aquaculture looking for people that knew about fish. Like, oh, this could be perfect for me. So I ended up moving to Nova Scotia and working at a halibut hatchery as a hatchery technician. And I loved it. I got to work with halibut, and it was really interesting. And I might have stayed there maybe for the rest of my life, except that the company did a lot of really cool research projects with the Canadian government, the National Research Council. And I loved working on the research projects. So I had the opportunity to do a research project looking at halibut nutrition and looking at sustainable feeds for halibut and improving sustainability of the industry. And from there, I did a PhD working on similar aspects of nutrition, looking at sustainable feed resources, finished the PhD and did a postdoc sort of looking at fatty acid production and looking at aquaculture systems kind of in a more broad way. And I came here in 2017 and loving it ever since.
Oh, that's great. So you work at the aquaculture nutrition division and you're located in Nova Scotia. So what type of studies does your department of animal science and aquaculture actually do? I know of some recent ones, but perhaps there's many different facets of it.
In general, in my department, myself and my colleagues are focused on animal production, and you know, some of the other professors are working on poultry, some of them working on dairy, and a few of my colleagues are working on fin fish and shellfish production, looking at in terms of biology, genetics, behavior. Myself, I'm working on nutrition. And all of the projects that we're working on, the research we do here, are really working to aim to build sustainable and resilient animal production systems, including fish. You know, it's no different than livestock that we're growing for chicken and beef. I mean, it's different, but we're all focused on the same thing, and that's, you know, improving our food production systems. With my work in nutrition, I'm focused on improving sustainable aquaculture feeds that can benefit fish growth, but also improve fish health and immunity. And so I work on things like looking at new ingredients for the feed, doing different tests on the fish, even looking at product quality, like the final nutrient composition, the final taste and sensory quality. All the way from egg to plate, really looking at all the nutritional aspects.
Well, that's great. And let's dive into a bit of those studies then throughout this next 25 minutes or so. So, and I had read an article that was profiled some of your work in the New York Times recently. And I think that was about the nutritional value of salmon that's available for purchase by consumers in North America. So can you please tell us about that study and gathered quite a bit of headlines, actually?
Yeah, so there's been a couple of studies that we've done now on in that area. And I'll just talk about why that study even started, is that people were telling me that they wouldn't eat farmed salmon because it was bad for you. And this was not an area of research that I planned or proposed on doing when I came here. But it seemed like a natural fit that if the public is concerned about eating farm salmon because it's not good for you, well, I have all of the tools to do all of the nutritional analyses that I could do. So why not compare them? So I dug into the literature, and there wasn't a lot of studies looking at the nutritional composition of wild and farm salmon. What's the difference? Is there even a difference? And if there is, what are the differences? So that was the kind of the inspiration for the first study that we published in 2020. And it was really to look at wild and farm salmon. So I went out to the grocery store just like any other consumer and got as many different types of salmon as I could. It turns out we had, you know, quite a few different species to choose from. So Atlantic, Chinook, sockeye, pink, and we analyzed them for protein, fat, fatty acids, cholesterol, iron, all different types of nutrients. And we even looked at a contaminant as an example, which was mercury. How it turned out is that the biggest differences were between species. So even within wild salmon, there were really big differences between sockeye or Chinook compared to pink, for example. So what we found in that study is that the nutritional differences aren't because they're wild or farmed. It's because the species are really different. They eat different things. They live in different places. They have different biology and metabolism. There's lots of different reasons. And so it's really not if it's wild or farmed, it's based on the type of salmon. And that's a beautiful thing. We can have different types of salmon for what we feel like even we eating, we have that choice. But it's not because of nutritional differences, even for mercury. So mercury is a type of contaminant that Health Canada, for example, tells people to watch your consumption of that. And salmon's not even on the list, by the way. Like, it's so low. All types of salmon are really low in mercury. It's things that are more higher up in the food chain, like tuna and swordfish and things like that. But I did want to look at it nonetheless, just to look at differences. And again, no difference in mercury between wild and farmed. There's differences among species. And yeah, all of the concentrations of mercury were really low. But again, if you want to look for different flavors, different levels of fat, different levels of omega-3s, there were some differences among species. Pink salmon having the least like nutrient dense. So for every bite of pink salmon, you're getting less nutrients than you would if you ate farmed Atlantic or wild sockeye. So wild sockeye, wild Chinook, and farmed Atlantic had the highest nutrient density. So for every bite you get, you're getting more nutrients than you do for pink, which actually has more water in it. So if you're looking for like a low fat, lean option, low calorie option, go for the pink then. So there's different choices for your different dietary needs, I guess you could say.
Yeah, and I mentioned off the top the study back in 2004 that looked at PCBs, and I mean, even in the headline, it kind of ranked farmed against wild. It never, although in the study itself, it did look at all the different species. By the time you get to the headline, it just lumps wild salmon against farm salmon. And you're exactly right. I mean, there are so many different species that all have different nutritional value and contaminant levels. But at the end of the day, it's all really good for us and healthy, right?
It's all really good. It's all good no matter like what type of salmon that you want to have. I mean, I find that comparison farmed and wild to be interesting because you're saying farmed and wild, you're not even comparing the same species. Like most of the farmed is Atlantic and most of the wild are Pacific species. So you're not comparing apples to apples here. You're comparing apples to oranges. So you can't really make that comparison. And I learned that a lot of people don't realize that when you buy Atlantic salmon in the grocery store, people think that's wild. Like people don't really know that they love eating Atlantic salmon. But they say that they prefer wild, but they're always eating farmed Atlantic and they love it. So I think that's an important distinction to make is that with the species, when you're comparing farmed and wild, you're not even comparing the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's fascinating. So what has the reaction been to your study? Because I've seen it profiled in many publications and online.
Most people honestly did not know this information. So generally, I think the reaction I've got is curious and positive, like, oh, I didn't know that. If you look at people's opinions on a spectrum of salmon, there's people, a lot of people in the middle that don't know anything about it and would love to learn more. And I feel like that's the biggest reaction that I've got from the study. Then there's a group of people that are, they already knew this and they're already like, yes, I love farm salmon. It's the best or whatever. But then there's another group of people that really this study wouldn't impact their opinion at all. And you know, that's kind of maybe the more difficult part is the opinions of some people that no matter the research that we put out there and talk about it in a public forum, it doesn't really seem to make a difference. So I'm kind of more focused on the 80% of people that want to know more about it. And I think with studies like these, the reaction was more inquisitive and positive to learn this information if they didn't know it already.
Correct me if this isn't the right way to phrase it, but is it more about nature than nurture? If it's about the species and about what they eat, we always talk about, you know, what builds you as a person. Is it nature or nurture? But what is it for salmon?
I think it's a bit of both, if I understand your question right. Like for salmon and most animals, you can't change their requirements. Like you can't change what they need from the nutrients. But you can change what they eat compared to what they eat in nature. Like salmon are not eating pellets in nature, but farmed or wild, you're getting 50% protein and 20% fat. We know from an aquaculture science perspective, that's what salmon would need, for example. You know, naturally, salmon are carnivores. They eat other animals. They don't really need to eat fish per se. They need the protein and the fat and the essential fatty acids and the vitamins that come from those food sources that they get. So you can achieve that exact thing by changing different ingredients to achieve those nutritional levels. And so in that sense, I think it's a balance between nature and nurture. You're not going to change what they need, but you can give them what they need, even if it's not exactly what they would have in nature.
Now, when I was in Europe many years ago, I did try a wild Atlantic salmon and a farmed Atlantic salmon. And I eat a lot of salmon, but I was unable to tell the difference. And I noticed that your study didn't, because of course the wild Atlantic salmon is not available to consumers in North America, but would that be a logical perhaps follow-up study just to see?
I would love to be able to do that because, I mean, you can't buy it, so I can't even get it myself. A study came out in 2020, Jensen et al., looking at Norwegian farmed and wild salmon, and the farmed and wild salmon were quite similar in their nutritional composition. Atlantic, just focusing on Atlantic only. And that's like the true comparison when you take kind of species out as a factor. You're looking at the same species comparing farmed and wild. So I would like to be able to do that. But based on that study, I think that the difference is very minimal.
A renewable plant-based protein, Imperial 75, is the sustainable choice in a changing world. This high protein corn concentrate creates more space in the diet by reducing the need for fish meal or other protein concentrates. Efficiency and performance with an eye on the future. That's the Imperial 75 way. Learn more at imperial75.com.
So we talked about feed, and feed being a huge contributor to the nutritional value of a salmon, obviously. And you mentioned off the top that you had looked into alternative feed ingredients. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, and that's an area of research that I'm really interested in and excited about, is looking at new ingredients. I mean, feed has changed so much over the years, even since I've been involved in the industry and going to grad school. Like it's evolving. Commercial feeds, I mean, as you know, started out being primarily fish meal and fish oil based, and which everyone recognizes that's kind of problematic from a biodiversity perspective and a sustainability perspective, an economic perspective. So, you know, a lot of research in the 90s and the 2000s were focused on trying to replace fish meal and fish oil. And a lot of that was with terrestrial plant meals and oils. And that's exactly what I was working on as a master's and PhD student. So because of all that research on a global scale, like tons and tons of work, most farm salmon feeds have significantly less fish meal and fish oil used in it. And even when fish meal and fish oil is harvested now, a huge proportion of that is recycled and used toward making fish oil pills and things like that. Like, you know, we harvest the edible portion, but a lot of it is reused. That's just a side note. So now fish meal and fish oil in the diet is like less than 20% compared to what it used to be, maybe 70 or 80%. So that's huge. But now I think in the last 5 years, there's a bit of recognition that there's some shortfalls with using primarily plant-based diets. There are own sustainability issues. There's also some issues with, you know, including more plant ingredients for a carnivorous species. But mostly it's because in the marketplace, there's becoming some more, maybe better alternatives that kind of fit the bill for sustainability and also really good for salmon and other fish species. And that includes, you know, insect proteins like black soldier fly meal and microalgae oils and biomass. Those are the two kind of really hot examples right now that are just kind of on the brink of becoming huge commercially. And I think these have a lot of potential. There's been a lot of research in the past couple of years about the success of it as an ingredient to either replace fish meal and fish oil, which we've already replaced it with terrestrial plants. So we're really kind of replacing the replacement, but showing success at replacing some of the terrestrial plant meals and oils. And we still will use plant meals and oils, but we need to kind of increase the basket of raw materials that we have and options, so we can put a little bit of this and a little bit of that to achieve this nutrient requirements that the salmon need or other fish need.
Another thing that I mentioned off the top was omega-3s. And of course, it's, you know, the big seller for salmon. You talk about nutrient density. It's the best way to get your omega-3s. Even I know that. So knowing that and knowing that replacements may alter the level of omega-3s, what does the sector need to do to ensure the balance of both? And are we achieving that?
I mean, yeah, that's a good question. Some of the new ingredients, like the microalgae, for example, like that has even more DHA than fish oil in it. So you can even use less microalgae oil than you did fish oil to get a better nutritional profile. With any research study we do and looking at, in my lab, looking at replacements of fish meal and fish oil or replacements of terrestrial oils, we look at what's the final product quality, like what is the omega-3 after you've fed this fish for an entire year? What's the fillet fatty acid profile look like? And some of these alternatives are even boosting that. So just comparing like omega-3s maybe 20 years ago of actually maybe more than that, 40 years ago, if you compared wild salmon compared to farmed salmon that was fed a primarily fish meal, fish oil diet, you would probably see more omega-3s in the farmed salmon than you did in the wild salmon. They didn't need that much, but that was what came with having fish meal and fish oil. Then that kind of balanced out over time and people were like, there's way less than there used to be. Well, if you compared that to wild salmon, it's actually the same now. And so now, you know, we could potentially get a boost of microalgae, but just thinking about resources that will take to grow the microalgae, not that it's resource intensive, but let's just put in what we need instead of totally boosting it and overdoing it. That's just my opinion, but the potential is there to have even higher levels of omega-3s in salmon if we wanted to, not that we need to.
Yeah, it's still your best bang for the buck.
Especially compared to other protein options out there. You are nutritionally, for every bite, you're getting way more nutrients in salmon than you are from any other plant or animal-based protein.
Yeah, I remember a friend who, you know, figured they're a nutritionist for the day, told me that he'd be better off eating yogurt because it has omega-3 in it now. And when we did the math, we realized that you'd have to eat about, 1,000 liters of yogurt to get a portion of salmon omega-3. So you can do it, but you'd be sick of yogurt by the time you were done. So That brings us on, and as we near the end here, I'd like to talk about communications, because you are active in communicating about nutrition and your science. Some scientists like to communicate and others don't. Before we talk about kind of your approach to communication, let's bust another myth, because I'm figuring if you're a nutritionist and you've done some studies around feed, you probably know that people ask about the color of salmon. You know, the rumor is that salmon would be pale white unless it was fed a dye. So let's just talk about carotenoids and the color of salmon, if we don't mind.
Yeah, like I was saying to you earlier, that last year I was seeing a lot of misinformation on social media, like TikTok and Instagram, and it was bugging me so much that I decided to write an article about it in The Conversation, which is a news outlet for academics to write in for the public to view for free. So I did
it's
that.
The Conversation, is that what it is?
The Conversation, it's called The Conversation. Yep.
I see.
Go to theconversation.com, you can read this article. But astaxanthin is the carotenoid. That is the actual molecule that is red in color. And it's a nutrient. It's not a dye. It's something that fish actually use. Yes, it gets stored in their fillet, but they actually use it for reproduction and immunity. Astaxanthin is also an important antioxidant, which helps with immunity. So it is put in the diet, and it's put in there on purpose, not just for the color, but for actually the health of the salmon, just like we would put in a vitamin or a mineral. The color astaxanthin is not something new to us. It's why flamingos are pink. It's why shrimp are red. It's why salmon are red. It's ubiquitous in the aquatic environment. We've seen it everywhere. So, I mean, how do we get astaxanthin in the diet for fish? Well, there's two ways you can get it. Either it's actually a man-made molecule, like it's synthetic, just like some of the vitamins and amino acids that we take. Or some of the new ones are natural. And an example of that would be microalgae. Some of the microalgae produce a lot of astaxanthin. And so the industry is starting to use more of that variety. But astaxanthin is good for our health. So when you see salmon that are red, you shouldn't think of it as a dye. It's a nutrient, and you're getting more antioxidants for that.
Brilliant. That's very helpful to our listeners, I'm sure. So thanks for clearing that one up. So on communications, which is exactly what we're doing right now, you're a scientist. Like I said, some like to communicate and others don't. And science can be very difficult to communicate. So let's chat for a couple of minutes just about, you know, where the sector finds its challenges, because it's very science-based, it's very technical-based, and the argument against it can be very emotional. And we have a harder time kind of going there. So how do you kind of play in the field of communications from a scientist perspective?
I don't really have a strategic approach to this, like, at all. I like doing the science part, and I guess it originally started when I was a grad student of, like, I would like to talk to my family and friends about what I was working on, just on a personal level. And I liked for them to be able to understand. And so, you know, fast forward a decade later, I still enjoy the same thing of, like, doing the science, which is publicly funded. The Canadian government gives me funding to do this to better the lives of Canadians. And I just feel like that would be rude of me to not share it in a way that other people deserve to know what I'm finding. And if I actually want them to understand, I have to say it in a way that's, like, clear and understandable. I guess that is an approach, but I just never really thought of it that way. That's just how I think of it, is that if I'm doing this science for Canadians, then I owe it to people to share it.
Yeah, it's similar to, we had in season one, Chef Andrew Gruhl appear, and he was the same. You know, I know what's healthy. I know what's good for you. And it would be a disservice not to tell my customers why you should be eating more seafood, you know, if you want healthy food. So he likes to communicate that. So agree. Do you notice that, you know, articles on nutrition or health or advice, and, hey, let's flag Netflix here, latest series, You Are What You Eat. You know, you would think that they would be talking to nutritional experts like you, but we fail to hear from any experts, and we get other people that I will call non-experts, and that's me being very polite. Does that frustrate you?
Yes. Like, yeah, it kind of does, because a few of my friends send me that Netflix. I didn't hear of it before, but they sent it to me and they said, is this true? Is farm salmon, like, really that bad for you? What should I do? Like, I really need to watch this. And then I watched the first episode, and I'm ashamed to say this, but I really couldn't finish it because it was just, like, kind of annoying me too much. But I really should, so that I could have a more intelligent conversation about why it's not correct or whatever. But I did read a really good sort of a rebuttal article to that. I forget what it was now. But anyway, it's not balanced. And science is balanced, and the arguments are balanced. It considers all sides of things. And I just feel like that, like many other Netflix documentaries, are very one-sided. And that's for entertainment purposes. And it's unfortunate that it isn't necessarily for a learning purpose, because there was, as I heard, a lot of misinformation about it.
Yeah. I read some reviews, and people said, you know, 10 minutes in, they realized what this was. It was more an agenda piece, but it really lost the opportunity to have a really neat discussion around the nutritional values of different foods and health. And it just kind of lost the plot. I wrote a opinion piece. It was called Netflix, What Are You Feeding Us?
What I read, actually.
Maybe it was. Yeah. So I did painstakingly finish it to the very end. And I can tell you, when you watch the scene where three individuals have their hands just mushing through the salmon to make a salmon pate, it almost makes you laugh when they talk about the quality of the salmon. It's but that's great. Well, we really appreciate having people like you that that are there and available to speak about nutrition as well. One last question, just what do you think the sector can do? And not putting all the pressure on you, but what do you think the sector can do to communicate the value and nutritional value of salmon to make sure that it's just not confusing for people? Because right now, I think it is.
I don't think I really have any smart advice to give the sector of tackling this issue. Like it is a really big issue, and I feel like I'm trying to play like a small part in doing science that might be useful, or at least just getting information out there. I will say this though, we've done a couple of surveys of Canadians asking them about salmon and farmed salmon. And the first survey we did surveyed over 10,000 Canadians, and 80% of them regularly enjoy salmon as part of their diet. Over half of them said that they believed that aquaculture is a sustainable way to harvest seafood in Canada. So I think we tend to focus on a lot of the negative comments because we want people to understand because it seems like they don't understand. But don't forget about the 80% of people that do actually want to understand. And those are the people that we can provide the information to. I wish there were more open and balanced conversations out there. And I guess the industry, things have changed, and you've probably noticed this too, from people like you that are doing a good job of communications. But I think that people are more informed now than they were 20 years ago. Like they didn't even know what it was. And the fact that 80% of people, will regularly enjoy salmon, and over half of Canadians saying that they support aquaculture, really speaks to that. So I guess I would just say don't give up. And in terms of communication piece, keep sharing science and make it as, accessible as possible to everyone in a way that is really clear and understandable, and keep doing the science to show the facts. And I mean, it's hard to argue science, but we all know that there's that small portion out there that it doesn't matter what you say, they won't listen anyways. And those people tend to be maybe the loudest that have, oppose aquaculture. But don't forget about, the mostly the, 80% of people that are open-minded to it. So that's kind of the audience that I'd like to speak to more, so they are armed with that information.
Stephanie, I think that's a brilliant way to end this podcast episode with that reminder. So thank you for that. And thank you for taking the time with us. We really appreciate it. And hopefully we'll talk to you in the future about more studies down the pipe.
Thanks for speaking to me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Salmon Farming Inside and Out. If you have a comment on today's episode or would like to suggest a topic for future episodes, connect with Aquaculture North America on Twitter, now known as X, or through our LinkedIn and Facebook pages. This podcast is sponsored by Imperial 75, a Cargill branded feed product. As a high purity, high protein corn concentrate, Imperial 75 gives you more freedom to formulate, more freedom to innovate, and the power to achieve more. Find out more at imperial75.com.